welcome back to the Spartan History Podcast. This is episode 14, Jason and the Golden Fleece Part 2. In the first part of this retelling, I went back a generation before Jason's birth and described the circumstance of fate that engineered his eventual adventure to Colchis. I'd like to start this episode by going back a little bit again, not so much into the narrative, more into the earlier oral traditions and their subsequent evolution into Apollonius' Argonautica. The chronology of the heroic age can often be a minefield of contradiction, especially under close examination. But step back a little, turn the scrutiny down a fraction, and you'll see that most of the events earmarked for this phase correlate nicely with six or so generations of history, albeit purely mythic. The generations don't correspond with years so much as family lineage, and within their span of time rested all the great myths of the heroic age. The Iliad stamps its authority on the fifth generation, and therefore the Argonautica is set in the fourth and before Troy. Many of the Argo's crew had children who went on to fight, and in many cases die on the field of Priam's city. Homer acknowledges it as an older story, referring to it in the past tense when he says in the Odyssey, "The only vessel that ever sailed and got through was the Argo on her way from the house of Aeetes." Referring to the Straits of Messina between Italy and Sicily, it was a route Odysseus would travel too. Personally, a strong case should be made for the legend predating the Trojan War, not just in the narrative form, but also as genuine oral history. Stories are generally built upon over time, and the mythological world of Greece was one that evolved over its existence, with each successive generation embroidering the landscape. Homer didn't create the world of the Iliad and the Odyssey. He ingeniously wove an immortal story of anger and of homecoming into a world well understood by the audience at the time. It's difficult to look past the influence of the Iliad and the Odyssey due to their sublime nature and the mere fact that they survived. But the stories of Bellerophon, Perseus, and assuredly the Golden Fleece were undoubtedly equally as popular in their day. I'll take a quick look now at where I think the genesis of Jason's story might be found. We need to go back to pre-Mycenaean times and look elsewhere entirely. I've spoken before about the influence the mighty civilizations of the East have had on the development of Greek myth and culture. Although not as popular as Hellenic mythology, it can't be overstated how important early Babylonian and Sumerian legends were to the development of their Greek counterpart and descendant. To cite a prime example, the legendary founder of Thebes, Cadmus, is a personification of that impact. Having been born to a royal house of Phoenicia, he left his native home at the instruction of his father, who charged him with finding a missing sister, Europa. Naturally, it was Zeus who took her, though pointing that out at this point seems redundant for my learned listeners, who would, by now, expect nothing less. Finding his way to the Delphic Oracle, Cadmus was encouraged to follow a special cow until it rested, and on that spot found a city. Thebes was born as a result, and its first king shared with his people the system of writing he'd brought from Phoenicia with him. The Greek alphabet is indeed a product of the Phoenician one. Even though its actual introduction into Greece, around the late 9th century BCE, can't be reconciled with Mycenaean Thebes' founding at 1400 BCE, it matters not. Regardless of chronology, this still shows brilliantly how kernels of truth can be plucked from legend. There is some good evidence for the fundamentals of Jason's tale to have originated in the East as well. The first thing to look at is an ancient Hittite festival celebrating the return of spring known as the Pyrrhuli. Its overall function isn't important, but within the traditions lie a peculiar ritual whereby a bag made from sheepskin was hung from a tree. Sacred to the god of war, the Cursor, as the bag was called, held great riches and the secret to immortality. Metaphorically a representation of an anticipated good harvest after winter's recess, this ritual bears striking similarity with the golden fleece hanging from a tree within the sanctuary of Ares, the Greek god of war. The word Cursor, too, is a fascinating one. It entered the Greek language as bursa and comes down to us as purse, a word synonymous with the storage of wealth. Cursor is also cognately aligned with the Greek word for gold, chrysos, although it must be said that this could be purely coincidental. Another possible Eastern link is borne out by the famous Greek geographer Strabo, who wrote around the time of Augustus. In his magnum opus, known as the Geographica, Strabo describes the lands and customs of the known world, which for a Roman Greek at the beginning of the Principate was a reasonably broad one. Of interest for Jason is a particular practice used by the people of what is now modern Georgia for sifting alluvial gold. In Strabo's words, "In their country, The winter torrents are said to bring down even gold, which the barbarians collect in troughs pierced with holes and lined with fleeces, and hence the fable of the golden fleece. Presumably the fleece acted as a filter for the gold flecks. Studying the process further, it seems that these water and gold-logged fleeces were hung up to dry in a tree, and the gold was then brushed out once dry. Now that sounds tantalizingly familiar to me. A quick note on the term barbarian used by Strabo there. A very common Greek phrase used pejoratively to denote anyone not speaking Greek, or even by the Athenians against other Greeks who didn't speak their pure form of the language. It's a real onomatopoeia, whereby, to a Greek, the sound of foreign languages sounded like bar-bar, or gibberish to their ears. Barbaros, in ancient Greek, it looks to have a Mycenaean root, as there is a linear B word, paparo, used in a similar context. Anyways, Strabo also mentions that the locals of the region believe that King Aetes did once rule in the Colchis, modern-day Georgia, and that in his time the name was still extremely popular. Now these foreign anecdotes may or may not have anything to do with the creation of the Jason mythology, but in the same way that an earthquake may later be taken as Poseidon's displeasure, they can't be ruled out entirely either. As I mentioned before, the tale is visible to us for the first time in the Homeric epics. Unlike the story of Meleager and the Caledonian Boar, or even Bellerophon, the narrative isn't embedded within the epic. In fact, Homer pays very little attention to the story itself and only mentions it in passing. There's some interesting debate around why that might be as well, considering that a great many of the Achaean heroes descended from the Argonauts. Some of the discussion centres around the resemblances of the story between the Odyssey and the Golden Fleece. From the episodic nature of both epics through to the places both legends visit and the beings encountered that are in many instances the same. There's even some talk over whether or not the author of the Odyssey, Homer or otherwise, plagiarised the story of Jason, at least in part. None of that really holds any water in my mind, as at the time of the Homeric epics we can't detect anything like a complete narrative for the Argo and her crew. It isn't until the writing of Apollonius in the 3rd century BCE that we can reliably see the full picture, and in that case, it's just as likely that this later work plagiarised the Odyssey. Similarities in legend are nothing new, though, and the world these characters inhabit is a shared one across the Greek world. Indeed, the stories of Perseus and Bellerophon were so similar that they practically merged in the classical period. The number of references Homer makes to Jason total 3 across his works, 2 in the Iliad and 1 in the Odyssey. I've quoted the latter previously, merely to show a knowledge of the Argonauts' events having preceded the Odyssey quest. The other two discuss a man named Eunias of Lemnos, who both Achilles and Patroclus had dealings with. His epithet is the son of Jason. As we saw previously, Lemnos was one of the first ports of call for the Argo. Jason fathered Eunias, while he and the rest of the crew took up with the female inhabitants of the island, who'd recently killed every man on it for infidelity. They were harsh at times. Now this reference, not really helping to fill in any detail apart from confirming the visit to Lemnos, still supports the Trojan War occurring a generation after the quest for the fleece. Hesiod is almost entirely silent on Jason, though in his Theogony, King Aetes and his sister Circe are mentioned briefly, along with the king's daughter Medea, who would be pivotal to Jason's quest. By around the turn of the 6th century BCE, we start to see some evidence of the myth in the archaeology. Most of it is in the later red figure style rather than the earlier black figure. I'll put some of the images up on the website, and charming as they are, they don't really help a great deal in fleshing out the narrative's evolution. In some instances, the artwork can be downright confusing and show the variance in plotline at the time. One particularly well-preserved cup from 480 BCE shows Jason being regurgitated by a giant serpent with the assistance of Athena. The fleece does indeed appear in the background of the image, but isn't of central importance. We haven't got that far in the story yet, but I can assure you, as I've read ahead, Jason doesn't do any snake diving in Apollonius' version. Regardless, the descent into the belly of the beast, so to speak, is an extremely common archetype, and one found in a great many legends across time. The scene speaks to the fluidity of the story during the period. The 5th century BCE, in literary terms, is when things really started crystallising for the Argonaut story. Pindar composed what is largely believed to be his greatest work, known as the 4th Pythian Ode, in the year 466. In it, he gives a wonderful, though truncated version of the Golden Fleece myth that bears a great deal of semblance with Apollonius's Arcanautica. In fact, it's largely believed that he was used as a source by Apollonius. I can't recommend this ode highly enough. It's a work of pure art and freely available with a Google search. Do check it out. Working through the works of the great tragedians, Aeschylus wrote several plays that revolved in and around the myth, though none are extant. His Athamas most likely dealt with the aftermath of the king's children's departure from Orchomenos and the fallout that that created. The Lemnian women covered ground ripe for tragedy after the island's women killed their manfolk. He also wrote one called Phineus, a tragic tale of a seer too honest for the gods' liking. We'll meet him later in this episode. Thanks to Euripides, we have our only surviving tragedy dealing directly with the central characters of the Golden Fleece story. His Medea is set sometime after the events of the myth and deals largely with the breakdown of Jason and Medea's relationship. Actually, that's putting it lightly. Euripides really tears at your heart with this one. At the end of his retelling series, I'll go into it in brief. He also has a lost work known as the Mysians, which likely covered either the mistaken murder of the Doliones by the Argonauts or the subsequent loss of Hellas and Heracles. The ever-prolific Sophocles turned his hand to the topic as well, with at least six works covering various aspects of it. Most interestingly, he has a play called Amikos. He is one of the more memorable villains in the Argonautica, and he'll be coming up very soon. Moving away from tragedy, even good old Aristophanes wrote a comedy named The Lemnian Women, which most likely dealt with the dalliance the Argonauts had on the island of Lemnos. Of all these great lost works, it's this, no doubt salacious tale that I'd like to have heard the most, as the master of old comedy spurned the heroes for their human failings. If we take all of the above works into account, by the time the 5th century rounded itself out, it would appear that most of the pieces were in place for the story as Apollonius put it together in the 3rd century. He most likely had access to all of the aforementioned works, knowledge of the common mythology, and moreover, was head curator of the Library of Alexandria, singly placed to put together an epic for the modern audiences of the Hellenistic period. Although taking his lead from Homer in form and the use of epithet, the author's work was a sign of the times. Okay, we'll do a quick summary of Part 1 to bring us up to speed and then move on to the retelling of Arcanautica Book 2. But first, a quick word from my sponsors. Take it away, Mark.
In his final days, Alexander the Great's generals asked him who should succeed him. Alexander's answer, the strongest. Taken literally, this would see the close of the classical Greek age, an age thousands of years in the making. Join me, Mark Selleck, as I go back to retell the story of ancient Greece in my series Casting Through Ancient Greece. We will cast our way back to its beginnings, all the way through to the spread of its culture throughout the known world, thanks to Alexander and his generals. You can listen and subscribe to the series at www.castingthroughancientgreece.com, or you can listen on your favourite podcasting platform. Don't forget to follow the series over on Twitter at Casting Greece or on Facebook at Casting Through Ancient Greece. I look forward to seeing you there.
Casting Through Ancient Greece is an amazing podcast. Mark's work is incredibly well researched and delivered. His diction and turn of phrase certainly give the right amount of gravitas to the monumental events of Greek history he covers. If you haven't checked it out, please do, and support a fellow Australian. Right, so in part one of this retelling, I took things right back to the beginning, when the fleece was still attached to the magical, golden, flying ram. Transporting the fugitive children, Phrixus and Helle, away from their home of Orchomenos and away too from their evil stepmother. Poor Helle slipped off over the Dardanelles, or the Hellespont, as it was called in dedication of her death. Mr. Ram reached destination Colchis with the morose Phrixus upon his back, where it was rewarded for its service by being sacrificed and flayed. Its golden coat was hung in the sanctuary of Ares in that distant land, where it lay undisturbed for a great many years. However, fate had decreed that it would not lie there forever, and as Jason grew to manhood under the careful tutelage of Chiron the Centaur, they conspired to return the fleece to Greece. His father, the rival king of Iolcus, was imprisoned by his evil brother Pelias, and had his throne usurped. The time had come for Jason to reclaim his family's birthright, but ever wily, his uncle, the tyrant, seemingly turned the tables and had the young man sign what was thought to be his death warrant. All part of the plan, however, and Jason assembled a force of might not seen again until the Trojan War. The Argonauts came together on their custom-made vessel and set sail to a rowing tune struck up by Orpheus and his lyre, and headed east, Colchis bound. It wasn't to be smooth sailing for the crew. Before they'd even reached the Black Sea, all manner of ill had beset them. Between a layover on an island entirely populated by women, ruining a wedding by killing the groom and his groomsmen, and losing several of their number, including Heracles along the way, it really didn't look like they were going to make it. We finished just before the Argo landed in the land of the Bebrycians, so let's take it from there. Book 2 of Apollonius's Argonautica. No sooner had the crew dropped anchor when they were greeted by a haughty party of locals who had congregated along the shoreline. The biggest and haughtiest of the lot stepped forward to harangue the Argonauts. Without even introducing himself, he told the men that he didn't care where they came from or what their business was, only that they should know that any who arrive in Bebrycia must first submit to a boxing contest before they leave. Angered by the affront to themselves and the laws of hospitality by this stranger, the crew of the Argo all stepped forward to meet the challenge, but none were faster than Polydeuces. The brother of Helen leapt from the deck, feet landing squarely in front of his opponent. Limbering up before the assembled men, two sets of oxhide gloves were laid down before him on the sand. "Choose whichever pair you like. I won't be accused of playing foul at the onset of our fight. However, do take note with what skill they were made by my hands, and imagine how well those hands will splatter the blood on your cheeks," said the challenger to Polydeuces. Unamused by the Conor McGregor-style smack talk on display, Castor walked over to his brother to assist in the fitting of the gloves, giving his twin the "can-you-believe-this-guy" look. Apollonius juxtaposes the two warriors and their bearing in the following way. The one seemed to be a monstrous son of baleful Typhios, or of Gaia herself, such as she brought forth aforetime. The other, the son of Tyndareus, was like a star of heaven, whose beams are fairest as it shines through the nightly sky at evening tide. The Bebrycian swept upon Polydeuces like a violent wave, full of spite and malice. Although young, he'd grown up in warlike Sparta, and was no novice with his fists. He met the stranger, blow for blow, and slowly began to measure his strengths and weaknesses. The impacts of the strikes were felt by the crowd, and the speed at which they landed betrayed the eye. Bleeding, sweating, and gasping for air, the two combatants broke apart momentarily to catch their breath. Coming back together, it was clear to the observers that the fighters were tiring. The fight could not continue at its current ferocity, and one would have to give. As they clashed once more, the arrogant stranger made a fateful mistake. Lunging downwards with both hands, he sought to squash the Spartan prince. His younger opponent had anticipated a coup de grace, stepping nimbly back to avoid the blow as it passed. He then stepped inside the other's reach and delivered a crushing blow to the side of the head. Skull shattered and brains battered, he collapsed on the sand, stone-cold dead and nameless. Overjoyed at their champion's victory, the Argonauts gathered around Polydeuces to celebrate his victory, but the dead man's companions had other ideas. Slowly recovering from their shock at seeing the man who had defeated so many travellers defeated himself, they gathered up weapons and charged the crew of the Argo in blind rage. It would never be enough. Their targets were individually a match for an army, but together, well-nigh invincible. The few that survived fled off into the wilderness, leaving their champion and many comrades to lie bloodied on the beach, feasts for dogs and birds. Jason's men camped nearby for the night, and in the morning they took on what supplies they could and weighed anchor once more. Sailing from the northeastern shores of the Propontis, the Argo, with Tiphys at the helm, steered its way into the passage of the Bosporus. Here it seemed that Poseidon himself stood in their way, with a giant wave rising up before the ship, seeking to send it to the bottom of the channel. The skilled helmsman managed to turn the bow of the Argo in time to avoid disaster, but further travel would be impossible whilst the sea worked against them. Jason had Tiphys sail the ship to a nearby headland and dock. They were in luck, however, for unknowingly they had come to the place of the great seer Phineus's torture. Originally a king in nearby Thrace, Phineus had fallen on hard times due to his God-given gift of foresight. He knew the will of Zeus and the fate of all mankind. The problem was, he was just too damn honest about it all. For the most part, the Olympian king had nothing but utter disdain for mankind and his fellow gods. Having a mortal running around Telling everyone his secret plans was vexing to say the least. To punish this moralistic oracle, Zeus took Phineas' eyesight, his youth, and left him a blind old man in a sanctuary close to where the Argonauts had just arrived. But still, people sought him out as his gift was widely renowned. Those that received his wisdom left their gratitude in the form of foodstuffs for the old man's sustenance. Zeus had further plagued the seer by setting to guard over him the Harpies. Terrifying in appearance, Virgil in his Aeneid says of them the following: "Bird-bodied, girl-faced things they are. Abominable are their droppings, their hands are talons, their faces haggard, with hunger insatiable." Sounds nasty, but Virgil doesn't mention their droppings for some meaningless trivia, as poor Phineas well understood. Whenever some poor soul paid the oracle a visit and left a customary offering of food in return for the vision, the Harpies would descend and rip it from the old man's grasp. The beasts devoured whatever they could, but whatever was left, they defecated on. Yuck! According to Apollonius, after that, no one could stomach the food, so foul was the stench. Indeed, no one could even bear to stand near it. Pooey food aside, and all other ills notwithstanding, today was a good day for Phineas. He had long seen the day of his deliverance. Even if he couldn't physically see the Argo pulling him to shore, he knew succour was at hand. As the Argonauts approached the place of his eternal torment, Phineas made himself a suppliant at their feet, beseeching them not to abandon one as helpless as him, and moreover, he told them about a vision he'd had whereby two of their number would deliver him from his abject misery. With eyes unseeing, he stared directly at the Boreads, or Wind Brothers, so named because their father was Boreas, a personification of the North Wind. Individually, these Argonauts were known as Zetes and Calais, and the pair were renowned for their delicate and graceful hair that enabled them to fly. Hearing Phineas's pleas for help, and being of pious mind, the brothers immediately agreed to assist and set about planning a trap for the effluent Harpies. Simple in nature, the scheme worked brilliantly. After having prepared and served a meal for Phineas, the Boreads waited for their prey. They had but to wait a moment, for as soon as Phineas laid his withered hands upon the morsels before him, the shrieking beasts descended from the clouds, hell-bent on torment. Shrieks of malevolence turned to surprise and shock as the brothers, hair billowing, lifted up from the place of their concealment and set off in pursuit of the now fleeing creatures. They chased the Harpies far across the land and would have killed them too had not Iris, the messenger goddess, caught up with them. She gave her word that Phineas would be free from suffering now, but that Zeus himself had decreed the Harpies were to live and had other plans in store for them. Mollified by her words, the brothers turned back from the hunt to return to the Argo. Off the west coast of the Peloponnese and south of the island Zakynthos lies two small islands known as the Strophades. Translated into English, the name means the place of turning. Legendarily, it was here the Boreads circled back to rejoin their comrades. In the meantime, Jason and his men feasted Phineas and gave him his first untainted meal since his punishment had begun long ago. To repay them for the kindness shown, the seer shared with them stories of their future. First, he explained how the treacherous passage of the Bosporus might be made and warned them of the clashing rocks known as the Symplegades. He bade them follow his advice if they wished to pass safely through them. Fear seized the Argonauts as the blind seer told them of the fleece stretched over an oak tree within a grove to Ares, located in far-off Chalcis, guarded by an ancient serpent that never slept. He said that although well-placed, fear should not govern their hearts as the gods approved of the quest and they would receive many guides along the way, both mortal and divine. It was then, filled with food and drink, that the assembled men witnessed the return of the Boreads, windswept hair fanning as they alighted before the revellers to partake. Phineas kissed their hands in thanks. In the morning, the blind seer bade the heroes safe journey and to heed his words of warning. That was yesterday. Today found the Argo facing the aforementioned clashing rocks after having navigated the Bosporus. The two blue-coloured natural plinths rose up from the depths and although seemingly innocuous, the shadows they cast across the water were pregnant with menace. Following Phineas's advice, Jason released a dove to make the trial first. The crew held their collective breaths as the bird flew between the two sentinels, and it looked as if it would make it, when all of a sudden, the rocks slammed together, blocking the view of the other side and the black sea beyond. As they drew apart once more, The crew cheered as the dove could be seen safe and relatively sound flying away. However, there were a few tail feathers floating on the sea breeze, testimony to how close the bird came to being squashed. They now had a gauge of the speed required to pass the challenge. The men gripped their oars, and as Orpheus struck up a ramming speed tune on his lyre, they bent their backs to the challenge. Whipping the water, the Argo bucked at their collective might and sped between the looming rocks. Athena herself breathed life into the sail, further adding to the ship's impetus. The rocks began to close as they were almost through, and like the dove before them, they crashed on the tail of the Argo, tearing away an insignificant part of her stern. Safely through, Jason instructed his crew to row on. Turning back, he saw the Symplegades split apart for the last time. They would never again close, with the Argo's passage breaking the spell for all time. Tiffy steered the vessel along the northern Bithynian coastline, the southwestern extremes of the Black Sea. In ancient times, it was known as Pontus Euxanus, or the Hospitable Sea. According to Strabo, this was due to the many number of Greek colonies scattered around the sea's boundaries, making it a civilized place. Tired from their trials, the men drop anchor in the land of the Maridinians. Just as in Bebrycia, they were greeted by a party of strangers, but unlike the arrogance they received there, they were greeted here with smiles and warm welcomes. Their leader introduced himself as King Lycus and bade them come ashore and indulge themselves of his hospitality. Heading back to the king's palace for a feast, the man told the Argonauts to beware an individual known as King Amycus, who ruled over Bebrycia. It was a land adjacent overland from the home of the Merindinians and on the shores of the Propontis. Lycus told Jason and his men about how he had lost many of his men to the evil ways of Amycus, and that he forced any stranger to his land to match strength with him in boxing. Due to the man's strength and bearing, none walked away from such contests alive. Jason told King Lycus to be of good heart and to not worry, for they had already met King Amycus, though they knew not his name at the time. Moreover, Polydeuces had accepted the challenge and defeated the king in his own game. Lycus's men, overjoyed, hoisted the son of Tyndareus up on their shoulder and carried him in triumph to the palace with the king, promising to build a temple in honour of the Dioscuri together. The celebrations carried on long into the night, with promises of guest friendship being exchanged between the Argonauts and the Merindinians. In the morning, the quest still beckoned, and they hurried back to the Argo, with Lycus accompanying them to wish them well. It was here that the destined fate of Idmon, the Argonauts' resident seer, came to pass. Loading the supplies and gifts on board, the crew was startled by a bone-chilling scream coming from the muddy banks of a nearby river. In the blink of an eye, a mighty chthonic boar sped from its cover and attacked the assembled men. Before anyone could react, its foul tusks had pierced the thigh of Idmon, ripping through the veins, arteries, and sinews, leaving the bone exposed. With a scream, the hero collapsed. It was the cry that spurred his companions into action. Many of the Argonauts had previously hunted the Caledonian boar, and they made short work of the beast, with Peleus and Idas landing the killing blows. Returning to their fallen comrade, they raised him up, but his last breath expired, and Idmon passed from this world and into legend. Unable to leave now due to the funeral rites, Lycus stayed with the men as they constructed a tomb, slaughtered sheep, and bid the seer's spirit across the river Styx over 3 days and three nights of rites. Apollonius goes on to tell the reader that there are two tombs on that spot, for it was here too that after a short illness, Tiphys, the steersman, perished and was enshrined next to Idmon. Momentarily bereft of hope, Jason and his crew were unsure how to proceed. Achilles' father, Peleus, rose and gave a stirring speech to the men, telling them that they had many who could pilot the vessel and many who had access to the will of the gods through birth or design. It worked, and Ancaeus, another of Poseidon's sons, stepped up to the helm. It would seem perfectly natural for the leader and hero of the story to have given that speech rather than Peleus, but the Argonautica is interesting in the way it portrays Jason. Unlike the heroes of Homer's epics, who seem more god than man for the most part, Jason's son is very human in his failings. Only being made leader because Heracles originally declined the honour, he defers to his comrades in every test of strength, courage, or character, save one. Often timid and confused during situations of trouble, he is generally despondent and quick to anger and sheds tears at the slightest insult. An ordinary hero for the ordinary reader of the Hellenistic age, some 500 years post Homer and his great works. Moving on, it would be 12 days before the Argo could depart after losing two of its complement. Their next stop was nearby to the river Callichorus, where they beheld the ghost Thanalus. The son of Actor, he travelled with Heracles many years before on that hero's journey to retrieve the girdle of Hippolyta, the Amazonian queen. Dying from an arrow wound on the return journey, his comrades buried him on the spot of the Argo's arrival. It was his spirit that bade the ship stop at this point, and the Argonauts all filed ashore to pour libations on the tomb of the mighty Sthenelus. With the ghost propitiated, the crew once more boarded their vessel and rowed out to sea. They sailed for another 2 days, but the rough seas forced them into shore once more and they came to the home of the Amazons. These warrior women feature heavily in early Greek myth. Incredibly misogynistic in their treatment of women, the Amazons were a symbol of everything the Greeks feared in females. They lived amongst themselves, with no menfolk to speak of. Abducting males from nearby tribes for the purposes of breeding, they disposed of them afterwards along with any male offspring from the forced unions. Legendary archers, it is said that they burnt off their right breasts to enable the more efficient drawing of arrows. To a classical Athenian, whose wife would be closeted within the deepest recesses of the home and never spoken of in the company of unrelated men, the Amazons as an idea were a chauvinistic justification for the repression of women. A warning of what could happen if they were not controlled. Accordingly, they had the decency to live apart from men. They had prior to this time suffered an invasion by Heracles and his merry band of followers, who liberated their queen of her girdle in accordance with one of that hero's labours. The Athenian hero Theseus and his boon companion Pirithous also went to their lands. The Amazonian queen, Hippolyta, fell in love with Theseus, and betraying her people, left with him to rule at his side in Athens, minus one girdle. In revenge, the Amazons collectively invaded Attica and besieged the city of Athena, ultimately losing the contest. This war, known as the Amazonomachy, is portrayed on the western metopes of the Parthenon. To the Argo, whose crew was merely looking to avoid the storm, the bay seemed a peaceful place to wait for better weather, oblivious as they were to the land's inhabitants. As the sun went down, it looked an ideal spot, but with the rising of the sun in the morning, Helios revealed the dangers before them. Assembled along the coastline were the serried ranks of the fierce Amazons to greet them. Jason and his men took one look at them and correctly decided that discretion was the better part of valour, sailing back into the open water. Still in need of some time to resupply and refit, they next stopped at an island sacred to the Greek god of war, Ares. Phineus had warned them of this place and told that it was guarded by vicious birds. Not even Heracles could defeat them with bow and arrow, but had, through a device he'd created resembling a large bronze rattle, scared them off for a time. Not wanting them deterred, the seer had encouraged them to make landfall in the place regardless, though he gave no reason for this request. So, Jason instructed his men to cover themselves in bronze, and when the birds descended, as they were sure to do, make such a clamour with weapon against armour that, as before with Heracles, the winged terrors would be frightened off by the sound. The plan worked well, and as the Argo neared the shoreline and the birds dived to attack, the Argonauts struck up such a din that they immediately flew away. Concurrently, as the Argo pulled into shore, from the other direction limped in another vessel, badly battered and barely afloat. Coming near to the Argo, Jason could see four young men aboard looking a little worse for wear. When they came within earshot, all four collapsed to their knees and beseeched the Argonauts for relief. Jason's son, weary after so many misadventures, told them that they must first speak truthful about where they come from and to where they are headed before they would receive succour. The four men nodded their heads vehemently in dissent, and the eldest stepped forward to present their case. A storm 2 days past wrecked our vessel, and since then it has been a miracle that we had kept it afloat. We travel from the city of Ea in Colchis, and we travel to Orchomenos, where our father was born. Perhaps you have heard of him. His name was Phrixus, and he travelled to Ea on the back of a golden ram many years ago. There, he sacrificed the ram to honour Ea's king, Aetes. In reward for the sacrifice, the king offered his daughter's hand in marriage. We are the scions of that union. Our father has recently died, and his dying wish was for us to return to his home in Orchomenos and take up his birthright as rightful princes of that place. Jason replied, "Then you are more than just friends, you are kinsmen as well. For Athamas, king of Orchomenos, had a brother who ruled in Iolcus, my home, and was father to my father. Therefore, you are welcome to share our food and clothing, and welcome to join us. We will take you to Orchomenos, or wherever you please, but first we must travel to whence you've come, Colchis. Our quest is for the Golden Fleece, and to return it to its home in Hellas. The sons of Phrixus tried to persuade the Argonauts otherwise, citing the many armies King Aetes had under his command, and the insomniac snake that guarded the fleece as reasons against the expedition. Indeed, the king certainly wouldn't be kind to his grandsons for leading a boatload of heroes to Colchis to steal his most treasured possession either. The crew of the Argo remained undeterred and resolved to travel to Ea regardless. With no choice left to them, the brothers acquiesced to their rescuers' wishes and joined them in questing for the fleece. Now with guides who knew the route well, the Argo sped straight for Colchis along the northern coast of Anatolia. Sailing through the night, the morning sunrise showed the coastline turning back on itself and heading off towards the northwest. They had finally reached the eastern extreme of the Black Sea and the region of Colchis. At that moment, a giant eagle soared overhead, so large that its wing flaps disturbed the sails of the Argo. Apollonius digresses at this point to tell the reader that the eagle is the winged punishment for the titan Prometheus, heading east towards the Caucasus Mountains, where the giant lay chained for all eternity. The bird fed on his liver each day as it regenerated. Not long after the bird passed out of sight, the Argonauts could hear a faint scream from the titan as the eagle began its meal. A terrible fate, but one Heracles would soon alleviate Prometheus from. It's at this point, with Colchis finally in reach, that Apollonius finishes Book 2 of his Argonautica, and true to form, that I finish this part of my retelling. I'll pick up the thread with Part 3 of my retelling on Sunday, October the 18th, where we'll get into the climax of the Golden Fleece myth. The often maligned Medea will feature heavily, and we'll get to see the fleece up close and personal. Up next, though, we'll be turning to our normal broadcast, with Episode 15, Lycurgus, the Wolf Worker, coming out on Sunday, October the 4th. My intention is to tease apart the legend of this numinous being and understand how and when the individual attributions of his character came about in reality. It's an amazing story, and I really hope to have you on board for it. Until then, dear listeners, take good care and speak soon. Please check out my website, spartanhistorypodcast.com, where I'll have extra information relating to the podcast, along with photos and maps of the areas discussed. You can find me on Twitter at Spartan_history and on Facebook too at Spartan History Podcast. If you like this episode and are keen to hear more, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your pods from, and leave a review. See you next time.